Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Today, people write blogs, start businesses, and even meet their future spouses or at least their next date online using the World Wide Web. But just 25 years ago, this open worldwide computer network didn't exist. Tomorrow marks the 25th anniversary of its humble beginning. Joining us now to talk about that is Case Western Reserve University historian Peter Shulman. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
First off, just to define our terms, it seems like a lot of people use the term internet, the web, and online interchangeably, but are they the same? No.
No, that's right. So the internet has actually been around considerably longer than the World Wide Web. I guess one way to think about it is the web is a way of using the internet. The internet is the whole infrastructure, the architecture of computers communicating with each other, and the web is a way to do that.
Is there any other technological advance that you'd compare the World Wide Web with now?
You know, there was a book that came out a while ago about the Victorian internet, and it was trying to look at the telegraph in the 19th century as kind of a precursor to the internet and the web of today. And, you know, in many ways, it's very similar, right? It's a long-distance communication, nearly instantaneous, based on electricity. But there are a lot of differences. You know, back in the 19th century, probably at its peak, maybe 3% of Americans used a telegraph in a given year. Lots of people were affected by the telegraph, but most people didn't actually send a telegram. The internet's kind of different. Today, at least within a couple of years after the creation of the web anyway, millions of people, tens, hundreds of millions of people around the world had access to this new kind of network. And it's something that people had thought about for a while and fantasized about, a way to connect people, access the world's information. But in many ways, the web evolved and the internet evolved in ways that were not how anyone really expected.
So take us back 25 years and describe the circumstances of the World Wide Web's origins in 1989.
Sure. Yeah, so the web itself was, I mean, it's often attributed and rightly attributed to a creation of Tim Berners-Lee, who is a physicist and trained as a physicist and computer scientist programmer working at CERN, the European Particle Physics Laboratory in Geneva. And he began working there around 1980 and was very interested in something called hypertext, which was a software way of conceptualizing writing documents that could access other documents. We think of them as links today, right?
Okay.
The little blue words on our web pages. And so he got interested in that, started working on his version of hypertext that he called it Inquire. He left CERN, came back, picked up Inquire again, started working on it. But it took a good five more years of research to kind of marry that. Kind of in his concept, marry this idea of linking pages together with this thing called the internet. Now, the internet had been around for a while. The internet has origins that go back kind of to lots of places. And you know, one thing historians like to focus on is ARPA, which is the origins of ARPANET. ARPA is the Advanced Research Projects Agency from the Defense Department. And this really roots the history of the internet and later the web very much in the Cold War. And ARPA had gotten started as a consequence of Sputnik. It was one of the many American responses to fear of losing out technologically to the Soviets. And in 1962, 5 years after it was created, started funding a project on computers for defense. And the head of that project was a man named LCR Licklider, who was based at MIT. He's a psychologist, a computer scientist. And Licklider had this vision of man-computer symbiosis, and he started really working with researchers at universities around the country, around the U.S. in particular, kind of seeding his vision of how to get humans to kind of outsource the thinking, the stuff that they had to do, looking up data, performing computations, so they could maximize their brain time and thinking useful stuff, and let the computers do the work for them. Now, this wasn't how computing had really developed into the 1960s. And if you go back and look at in the 1940s and 50s and the evolution of computers, really they were big business machines. They would kind of run them to create airline schedules or calculate actuarial tables for insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
Interacting with computers on a constant back and forth basis wasn't how most people thought about computing, but Licklider did. And so gradually this project grows and universities start getting linked together. They had all sorts of technological challenges to overcome to do that. And along the way, we get email and other kinds of connection systems. And but then at the same time, all this is going on, and universities are experimenting with this thing called time sharing to figure out how they can maximize the use of the mainframe capacity. If different researchers all want to use the same machine and they want to make the best use of their time. So this is all going on. And at the same time, computers are getting smaller and they're getting cheaper. And into the 1970s, we start to see the emergence of the microcomputer, computers that are small enough and cheap enough that at least if you were enthusiastic and really cared about this stuff, you could afford to buy one yourself. And as computers start getting into people's homes, and businesses start looking for opportunities to sell software. This is where you start to see the origins of things like Microsoft and Apple, building the machines themselves. There are other companies, including one that was actually based in Columbus, CompuServe, that started looking for ways to link computers together. Have them, if you were, living in Columbus, and you wake up in the morning and you want to get some run some computation. Well, the computers that are over in California, well, the people who run those are still brushing their teeth. So they're available. They're not being used. And so CompuServe allows computers to connect via this new internet thing and make use of computing power. But it turns out the people who were using CompuServe didn't want to just run computations. They wanted to get information. So early on, newspapers start to provide content. Columbus Dispatch was actually the first newspaper, and all papers around the country and the world followed. And so gradually these different networks, these consumer networks grew, CompuServe and later AOL and a bunch of others. But meanwhile, this new thing that's happening over at CERN with Tim Berners-Lee, this new World Wide Web, is it's kind of outside any of those networks. It's something that could be available for one computer to talk directly to another computer, one computer to provide server content, here's some stuff, and a user on the other end to receive that stuff and then communicate back. And gradually that web, that's the web itself, mm-hmm. that just kind of engulfs the internet itself.
It makes me think of what came first, the chicken or the egg, because how would you have the World Wide Web evolve as it has without the fact that many, many millions of individuals could now access it?
Yeah, well, that was one of the challenges at the very beginning. So when Tim Berners-Lee first created his the first version of the web 25 years ago, it was just text-based. There were no pictures. There were no cat videos. There was no no way to do any of that.
Uh-huh.
And so the first couple of years afterwards, 90, 91, into the early 90s, you had people all over the world creating browsers. That wasn't a thing. No one had a browser before. It was kind of a framework to make use of, to kind of communicate with this new system. And until there was a browser that was really user-friendly and capable and competent, it was exactly that. It was exactly a chicken and egg situation. And so when the first browser that really took off, the Mosaic browser in 1993, this just transformed, people's access to the web altogether. And Mosaic eventually evolves in one end into Netscape, and another end, it evolves into Internet Explorer from Microsoft. And that's when people, over the course of the 1990s, start to be able to make use of the web for stuff. But there were problems, right? There were all sorts of problems. What do you do with all the stuff that's out there? How do you access the data? How do you find it? And one of the fascinating things about looking at the early web or trying to remember back to the early web was, this is before Google, before search, right? The companies like Yahoo were making lists of here are all the web pages you might want to visit. And it was a very kind of hierarchical, listing system, very much kind of like a catalog. No one could really envision what we had today. That's really kind of one of the amazing things about this story and about the history of technology in general, is as this technological system was evolving, no one really knew exactly what it was going to look like.
How many people, I know I was introduced to it by way of work, and you mentioned early on that universities were communicating with each other. How much was it institution-driven and a lot of individuals in those institutions were introduced to the World Wide Web that way?
Well, I think it's very much like computing in general, which was it came in for most people through the work world. Many more people had interacted with the computer at work rather than their home, you know, into the microcomputing revolution of the late 70s into the 1980s. And the internet, though, was a strange thing because networking, like connecting universities to share scientific data, research data, or connecting businesses to share, you know, time sharing for computing time, that was all going on in the 60s, into the 70s, into the 80s. But the web itself was, you know, it was kind of a cool thing, but didn't really have obvious business applications, right? The things that we associate with the web, shopping, videos, information, news, that kind of, in a sense, evolved organically as users demanded these kinds of services. Entrepreneurs of various stripes, you know, experimented and tried different products, and some took off, and some, like pets.com, alas, did not. the web itself is a very strange thing. I joked about cat videos, right? That wasn't anything that Tim Berners-Lee expected people to be using the World Wide Web for.
And yet
it's really popular.
What? How do you measure the growth? What's the metric you use to measure the growth? Is it just millions of users type thing, or is there something different?
Well, there are different ways. You could measure users. You have to, again, distinguish here. Are you talking about the web itself, or are you talking about the internet, kind of the infrastructure altogether? Because, you know, gradually, we've actually been seeing a decline in people using, at least in internet traffic being from the web itself over the past 10 or so years. Increasingly, it's video content, it's peer-to-peer content, sharing files directly over the internet from computer to computer. The web is becoming a smaller and smaller share of what people use the internet for. If you think about apps on your phone, right, those are not typically using the web itself. They might not have existed without the web to kind of, create these companies or ideas or services. But the apps themselves aren't exactly the web. But you can measure users. You can measure how people connect. You can measure devices themselves, which is getting increasingly complicated because it was one thing to count, you know, computers. It was one thing to say, you know, in 1990, there were 300,000 computers on the internet. In 2000, there were 100 million computers on the internet. Today, it's not just computers. You have automobiles that are on the internet. You have, you know, factories that are on the internet. They're computers in a sense. They're not computers like a laptop as we think about them, but they're connected too. And I don't know, 9, 10 billion devices around the world that are connected to this thing, and many of them use the web.
It's hard to imagine there's anything comparable to it. You mentioned the telegraph, but really, maybe the printing press?
But
that's different.
We historians of technology love making these comparisons and backing off. Like, oh, no, they're really actually quite different. the thing about both of them, it's another fascinating story. The thing about both of them is they took a long time to evolve into what we associate with them. There's a great scholar of technology and the internet named Sherry Turkle, and she had a line in her latest book that said something to the effect of, just because we've grown up with the internet doesn't mean the internet is all grown up. And it really captures the sense that, you know, the printing press, you know, when Gutenberg builds the first kind of, as we think of it, modern printing press, it didn't immediately create publishing industries. It didn't immediately create a culture of reading. It took a long time, and it evolved differently in different places. And it's really the same thing with the internet now. No one would have predicted exactly this kind of distribution of stuff we do online 25 years ago, and I think people would be hard-pressed to guess what the next 25 years or more are going to bring. And those are choices that we get to make, choices as consumers, choices as citizens. And those answers may look different depending on where you are and really who you are.
Well, Peter Shulman, thanks for celebrating the birthday today with us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Peter Shulman, he's a professor of history at Case Western Reserve University. Tomorrow is the 25th anniversary of the World Wide Web. Tech Tuesday continues. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The market for smartphone and tablet apps is flooded with choices. It can be hard to know what's best, especially when choosing for young kids. There are literally thousands of apps out there. Joining us now is the editor of the Children's Technology Review, Warren Buchleitner. Welcome back to the show, Warren.
Good to be with you, Ann.
And question for our listeners, what apps are your kids going crazy for? Give us a call and share your favorites. 614-292-8513. Before we jump into some of your recommendations, Warren, you wanted to discuss a trend you're seeing, further integration between toys and apps. What are you talking about there?
Well, what I'm seeing is that I was just at the American International Toy Fair in New York, and I saw a lot of the new toys. And it seems like every toy has an app. And a lot of toy manufacturers like Hasbro and Mattel and so on are basically, they're making a toy like Furby, but then they have a free app that you can download for your Android or your iOS device, and it supplements the toy in some way. So it's you're starting to see this kind of Webkinz effect on steroids, for just about every kind of toy.
Can you give me an example of what an app would do to supplement?
Yeah,
like
in My Little Pony, for example, there's a little QR code on the bottom of every little thing. So when you buy it, you can take your iPad, for example, and take a picture of that little code, and then it registers it. So it automatically turns it into a collectible, and it might give it virtual life. I mean, all these apps do different things, mm-hmm. but the scheme is to start making all toys, collectible items, so that then they can reproduce and you have to buy more. So it's sort of a reality, and it's sort of seeping into mainstream.
Now, we usually like to talk about apps that are fun for kids, that the kids enjoy, but also have some substance to them in terms of brain development, in terms of learning about the world around them. Does this trend that you're seeing, the integration between toys and apps, is this capable of embracing those values as well?
To some extent, but to a lot of kids, it's just a distraction. Kids want to play a good app, and when they're on the screen, and that's what I get most excited about when I find an app, particularly from a small publisher, that is just really high quality. So I think that in some cases it helps, in other cases it's kind of a distraction and sort of a side thing. But certainly everybody's heard now of Disney Infinity and all the Disney films and so on have app spinoffs and movie spinoffs. And so the app, it's just starting to be that If you see it in a book or a movie, you're likely to see it in an app and a toy.
But all those apps don't necessarily make good apps for kids just
because
they're toy-related.
They all vary. Some of them are better and some of them are worse. And some of them have just pure commercial agendas to try to get you to buy more toys.
Well, let's talk about some of them that you do like for the preschool age. Is it Toca Pet Doctor?
Yeah, we should jump to the headlines. If you have a preschooler, age two or three particularly, so that first app, get Toca Pet Doctor. This is another in the lineage of excellence from Toca Boca, the Swedish publisher that just keeps making these incredibly easy to play. There's no agendas, lots of ways to accidentally succeed. there's an earthworm that's tangled up in a knot, and you just swipe at it and untangle, and he gets a big smile, and then you feed him a leaf, and then you're on to cure another one. And they're all, they're all like little mini games, and just a lot of fun.
You say it's ideal as a child's first app. Let's first talk about how old a child should be. What are you talking about?
Well, I think every parent should judge that on their own. You know, even babies will jab at the iPad because it's causal. They can make things happen. And so the Tokapet doctor is perfect, as is there's a few here that have just come out that are really strong early apps, because I call it accidental success. You lean on the tablet, and it does something right, and you feel it makes you feel good. It makes you feel like, oh, I can do this.
So you want to go forward and try something maybe more complicated next?
Yeah, it expands in complexity, and it also there's language hooks. There's a lot of good things in terms of education. It also creates a nice context for you to play together, so collaboratively. So I might feed the worm the leaf, you know, this leaf, and you feed it the next time, and so on. So if you use it that way, it can be a really rich experience.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Warren Buchleitner. He's editor of Children's Technology Review. Why do I like the idea, Warren, of untangling that worm myself? Is there something human about that?
Well, you know, all these things pets have problems. There's a cat with fleas. There's a frog that's eaten too many flies. You know, there's something that's just fun about helping these poor critters, and they look so happy when you've cured them, and then you get to feed them again. So, yeah, it's like I have to confess I had a pretty good time with that app.
Another one is Busy Shapes. This is, again, for the preschool age. You like it. What is the play like with this app? What does it do?
Yeah, this just came out last week, and it's really incredible. It comes from France, from a studio that's called 7 Academy. It's a bunch of educators. And this is kind of like if Maria Montessori were designing apps. This is about as close as you can get, because it's a series of pegs and shapes, very simple, no instructions. And you start dragging them around on the screen, and you start to discover that, you know, the shapes go in certain holes and so on. And the better you do, the harder it gets. And this sort of automated exploration that expands in complexity geared on your progress is very exciting. And so I tried this one with a 2.5-year-old, and I put some video up on YouTube of the interaction, because it was just incredible how far this little boy got in a short time and how the app stepped in to help. And that's the key with this, is that it's not just a dumb material. This is a smart material that adjusts automatically.
You said artificial intelligence in the app tracks the time it takes each child to complete a level and increases the difficulty accordingly. Is that a common feature in apps like this?
Yeah, it's been around since B.F. Skinner came out with his teaching machine. So the idea that, branching, in computer-aided instruction, it's really not a new idea. What is new is you're getting it in a $1 or $2 app, and when it's done well, it can be very nice. And generally, the more granular the task, so like in this case it works because it's sorting shapes, the more accurate you can make the AI or the artificial intelligence. But applying it is really easier said than done.
By the way, with Tokapet Doctor and Busy Shapes, which is what we're talking about now, does it matter whether it's on, is there an enhancement if it's on an iPad or a tablet versus the smartphone?
Yeah, the larger screen is better for a lot of these things. They'll run on both, so you can try them on either. It all kinds of depends. Busy Shapes will work on a small screen rather well, because the graphics are so simple, as well as will Tokapet Doctor. Both are good for either the 4-inch or the 7-inch or the 10-inch screens.
You know, one thing about both of these, they Tokopet Doctor and Busy Shapes, they were developed in they weren't developed in the United States. It's kind of cool that these sorts of levels of play are universal. They transcend culture and language.
It is. It's wonderful. And you know, I'm just putting tomorrow I'm publishing our weekly, and it has all French. Every app came from a French developer, and I think it's great because it's pedagogy that is coming out of some leading Europe universities for the benefit of our children. And I think, and it's going the other way as well. Some of our app studios in the States are finding great success in other countries. So I think, isn't it interesting that iTunes is becoming the new UN of,
exactly.
of ideas?
Okay, for elementary age kids, you have a math game called Slice Fractions on your list. Tell us about that.
Yes, download this immediately. Pull your car over to the side of the road and download this. It's called Slice Fractions. This one is French, but it comes out of Quebec. All these came out within the last couple weeks, by the way, so they're pretty new. This is like, if you've ever heard of Cut the Rope, it's Cut the Rope meets Fractions. And the way they do it is it uses blocks of ice, and you help this little baby mammoth make it through this maze or this 60 different levels of puzzles. And you can get a lot of hints, there's a lot of help, but by the time you get to the end, you're doing all this thinking about, you know, you don't want to tell the kids this, but they're using numerators, denominators, equivalency, all these kinds of concepts that are playfully and gently introduced. It's called Slice Fractions. It's a phenomenal app, and comes out of Quebec.
By the way, we'll post links to these apps on our website at wosu.org/allsides. It was interesting that in the review for this game, you mentioned the Common Core concepts the game teaches. Are kid app developers really taking note of Common Core?
Most aren't. I put that in, and it's great when it does. It just kind of makes it so that teachers and people who are designing curriculum and say, yeah, that's a nice fit. Mm-hmm. In this case, it's great, particularly because it's leveled.
Okay, so if I ran a horse show, I used to love horses when I was a kid. I think a lot everybody does, and everyone knows someone who's obsessed with them. For those kids, there's a new book app.
I don't know if we've talked about Ocean House Media, the sort of book apps for a while, so I thought I'd put one on the list.
Okay.
We ran a review this last week, and of course, Ocean House Media is the studio that probably has 100 apps out there, and they're very similar in design. So if you've seen one, they have the Dr. Seuss apps. This is also a Dr. Seuss. It's called the Cat in Hat Learning Library. And I have daughters myself, and I've attended more than many, many horse shows.
Yeah.
And I've shoveled a bit of horse leftovers as well.
Uh-huh.
And enjoyed every bit of it. But as you know, horses have all these, there's a lot of science to horses and measuring and breeds and history.
Mm-hmm.
And this app playfully introduces those things. So if you have a child who's interested in horses and is also learning to read, this is a nice bridge because any word that you touch, you see it, hear it out loud, you also see it labeled. And I like the fact that the language is not watered down. So you see, you know, the real parts of the horse hoof, and you know, it's the real stuff. And those kind of word hooks when you have high interest areas like this are great. It's called If I Ran the Horse Show. And it's another in a series from Ocean House Media. And if you like this app, there's many more like it on different subjects.
There's an award-winning app available for children based on the story Peter and the Wolf, and it's in French. What makes that special?
Yeah, well, this is not for everybody because it's completely French.
Uh-huh.
And so if you want, you actually download it I was able to download it. I think it's in euros, but
okay.
It's the National Orchestra of France, basically gives you a peek inside the production of Peter and the Wolf. And I'm part of a jury of for the Bologna Children's Book Fair, so I get to go over to Italy and pick these apps. And this was the leading, this was the winner out of 258 submissions. And so I think that if you want to see state-of-the-art design, just aesthetic beauty on a multi on a retinal display, this will only run on the iPad. Check it out. It's called Pierre et la Loupe, or Peter and the Wolf. And it's Prokofiev's symphony, sort of an interactive version. So it's a delight. It's a delight to your ears. It's a delight to your eyes.
That's got me thinking about Peter and the Wolf, the music. Dun, 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 dun. Okay. A lot
yes,
of people.
Yeah. Once it gets in your head.
It's in my head now.
I'm pretty sure I put something up on YouTube on that, but you can find that. And I think it's good as a, you know, as a U.S., former U.S. school teacher. I used to love it when I could give kids an immersion in the real thing. And this is like a field trip to France. So I think it's pretty cool when you can do that. And it's not a lot of money to do that.
We have an email from Vicki. She brings up a topic we've talked about before. The American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended no computer or television screen time for children under two.
Oh, my gosh. Are they still with us? You know, I'm glad you brought it up because there's also a Huffington Post article that basically says that no kids under 12 now should use screens. And I think these people are getting kookier and kookier. I approach this issue from an academic perspective. I have a doctorate in educational psychology from Michigan State University.
Go Spartans.
And also, yeah, and I also taught elementary school, and I've also raised two kids. And I've never seen so many crazy academians quoting fake research or selling a book along with the stuff that they're selling. And it enrages me that they are trying to prey on parents' emotions. The fact is, you know, that the apps that we've talked about are so diverse, and you just can't throw them all into one bucket. And it also devalues the judgment of the parent here. So, you know, the American Academy of Pediatricians is very has very good intentions about this, but to completely, and I actually agree more in spirit with what they're saying below age two. But, you know, this is an area where there's too much at stake to just throw everything out the window here. And there's a lot of ignorance. So I encourage people to try these apps for yourself and make your own judgment. Don't listen to people with PhDs.
Even you, right?
Absolutely. I'm hoping you're getting my joke.
Okay. Warren Buckleitner, thanks for joining us again. We'll have you back soon.
And it's always a pleasure.
Warren Buckleitner, he is the editor of Children's Technology Review. Coming up, Russell Holly from Geek.com. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. A lot of video games get a good deal of hype these days, but one of the most anticipated game releases has finally launched, and it's got gamers in a frenzy. Joining us now to tell us more is Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. Wipe the foam off your face, Russell.
That was several hours ago. I've been up since 3 o'clock this morning.
You've been playing this game today?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I woke up. The game released to the Xbox One at 3 o'clock this morning, which was midnight Pacific time. So I set my alarm at 3, and I got up and started playing. And really, that's
all you've been doing?
I think I only stopped to talk to you, truth be told.
Gosh.
I've been playing.
All right. So we've talked a little bit about this game on the show before. I think you were saying it's going to come out, but remind us what Titanfall is and what it's all about.
So Titanfall is, first and foremost, a violent shooter. It is a future military, very intense action game where you play one of two sides that are fighting back and forth for control of pieces of land in a relatively arbitrary map. And you go back and forth choosing which side you want to be and you know, fighting the other people that are going on. What sets this game apart is the implementation of some really interesting futuristic stuff. Jetpacks for the human-shaped things that allow them to run across walls and kind of jump in a very futuristic manner, and then gigantic robots that they can climb into to run around and shoot things.
That's right. We talked about it from that movie.
From Avatar, yeah.
Avatar, right.
Yep, and it does have some striking similarities, including, I didn't see this until probably 4:30 this morning, and it immediately made me think of you. There is a map where there are these dragons all over the place that have four wings, very much like some of the creatures on Avatar.
Huh. So, and I love the jet.
There are definitely more than a few similarities.
And it's finally got the jetpack I've been waiting for since
I was a child. It does finally have the jetpack that we were all promised a long time ago.
And, yeah.
You know, there's just been a lot of slacking on behalf of whoever is in charge of that.
Yeah, yeah, I've been waiting a long time. So is there much of a storyline to the game?
No. So this is where things get kind of interesting and almost disappointing, is that the people who make this game have come together from different shooter games from all over the place. They formed this company called Respawn Entertainment, and one of the things they decided early on was that the idea of splitting the team in half so that you had half the team working on a complex story, with main characters and this kind of hero mode that you would go through and play, and then the multiplayer part of the game, where you could go through and play with all your buddies and do things, but splitting the team in half to do that was a big waste of time, because based on their research, there was a huge chunk of people who never even completed the campaign mode for a lot of the games that they worked on in the past. So they went and created an entirely multiplayer first-person shooter game that does still have a campaign mode with a little bit of story, but it's not a single player setup. You are playing with other people as you go through the story and learn about this world.
You have to play with other people.
You have to play with other people at all times. There are no other options. You must make friends.
Yeah, how steep is the learning curve for a game like this? How quickly do you, in other words, since 3 a.m., how far have you come?
So the game in and of itself is fairly complicated if you were to just pick up a controller and start playing. But the game itself does a really good job of having a tutorial that walks you through every single aspect of the kind of future tech and gameplay. And then the campaign itself really does get you acclimated with the mission types and, running around in your Titan and doing things in a fairly neutral environment, because everyone's kind of on the same page. But with a lot of these games, you have kind of like a level up system where you gain levels based on experience. And I am at 17 right now, and I think the maximum is 50. And I've seen a couple of people so far that are four and five levels above me.
How can you tell that they're above you? What identifies an individual that way?
It gives them a rank next to their name.
Oh, okay.
So it'll say like 20 or 22 or something like that. And those are people who are, in most cases, just playing better than me.
How many people do you think are playing this right now?
An enormous amount of people. Respawn hasn't given actual numbers yet, but Microsoft was ready when they announced the beta a couple of weeks ago for every single Xbox on the planet to get online and start playing. And that includes a separate PC version of the game for computers that launched at midnight as well on entirely separate servers. But so far, there have been very little problems for what has to be hundreds of thousands of players. And I assume by the end of today or by the end of the week, we'll have actual numbers from Microsoft and Respawn about how many people are playing. But before the game was even available in stores, it had already achieved some of the video game industry's awards for most pre-orders and things like that. It had already been a success in terms of sales.
Is this sort of the beginning of a franchise of games?
It's certainly possible. They have been talking about doing a sequel and expanding that sequel onto consoles like the PlayStation 4 or perhaps a Mac OS X version of the game. But so far, they haven't done much more than just kind of hint at it. Given its popularity, I can certainly see, either more in this kind of game or kind of offshoots in this world, like we've seen with other publishers.
Given that there's no real storyline, do you know if, like, toys or other swag, game figures will be sold? Do you think there's a market for that?
Well, they did a collector's edition for Titanfall that included a gigantic 20-inch statue of the main Titan that you use in the game. So I don't know that they'll go too much further than that at first. But as far as franchising stuff, because there are two different forces in the game, I can certainly see, militia badges or IMC badges being sold. But more than that, this is a huge opportunity for creative writers or people on the Respawn team who are part of, the kind of building part of the team to reach out to writers to create stories within these worlds. And we've seen that with Halo and with Gears of War and with several other really popular games.
How big of a deal, you said that it's breaking records and pre-orders and that kind of thing, how big of a deal is the success of Titanfall to the future of Xbox One?
Microsoft is putting an enormous amount of weight. The game itself requires Microsoft's special Azure servers to be online at all times and to be functional at all times. But beyond that, the Respawn team has had such a direct line to Microsoft that when the people building Titanfall decided that the controller was maybe a little too loose when it came to how it aimed, Microsoft actually released a patch for the controller to update it to Respawn's specifications. So obviously it's a pretty big deal for Microsoft that the Titanfall guys be happy.
We have an email from Dave who asks, are the robots like the movie Pacific Rim?
They're not quite as big as the Jaeger mechs in Pacific Rim. They are, I guess, probably about half that size, maybe even a little smaller. The Jaeger mechs were like building size. They're not quite that big.
Okay. These are more like the ones in Avatar.
They are a little tiny bit bigger than the ones in Avatar.
Okay.
They are much closer to that in concept.
Well, let's move on to Google Wearables, another topic we've discussed in the past. Google recently announced that it will be releasing a software developer's kit for wearable technology like smartwatches. What's the significance of that?
So a lot of the smartwatches that we have right now, they work really hard to earn the title of smartwatch, but they don't people. We have really cool email inboxes and social networks and things like that, and these smartwatches end up just kind of being dumpsters that live on our wrist for notifications. And that's cool if I want every single piece of junk mail ever to go on my wrist along with all of my other emails. But it would be way more useful if the person developing the email app or the social networking app could do more than just reach in and grab my notifications from my phone and push them to my watch. But they're really limited by what companies like Google and Apple make available to them. And Google's trying to change that with this software developer kit. What it will essentially do is offer developers a whole lot more in the way of tools to make their applications on things like watches and Google Glass and really any kind of fitness band or anything like that a lot more useful.
Why can't Google do that itself? Why doesn't it have enough people there working on things like that?
Well, they certainly will do it themselves. I fully, you know, a lot of times when Google releases a software developer kit, alongside of that comes like a reference design of some kind. Like with their phones, they release a concept for Android, and then they release one of the Nexus phones or tablets as kind of a demonstration of what that should look like. And so it really wouldn't be surprising at all. They haven't made any official announcements, but it seems likely that along with that software developer kit would come either a firm date for the public availability of something like Google Glass or a Nexus-style watch for users.
Do you have a smartwatch?
I have several smartwatches.
What do they do? I mean, they tell the time. You can get your emails.
So some of them are very simple, and they're just kind of stylish. That give me a little bit more information than a normal watch would. So like if I get a text message or a phone call or something like that, instead of pulling out my phone, I can just glance down at my watch. Some of them are good for turn-by-turn navigation. So that again, instead of having to look at my phone, I can glance down at my wrist, which is on the steering wheel, so it's already in my periphery.
Pretty cool.
And see what the next step in turn-by-turn navigation would be. And some of them have an entire app store associated with them that can do things like control smart bulbs and play video games and just get really crazy with this tiny screen mounted on your wrist. So, I mean, it really runs the spectrum right now. But there's limitations associated with each category right now with smartwatches, which is why most people don't own them, I think.
Tiny screen. What do you mean by tiny screen? Like, how tiny are we talking about?
They usually don't go too much larger than, you know, a 2-inch square on your wrist, you know, because a lot of people have, you know, relatively small wrists. I mean, there's not a whole lot of real estate there to begin with. And when you think about the size of the average watch, if someone's going to sell you a smartwatch, it can't be too much bigger than that. And that becomes complicated when it comes to, you know, making sure that the right hardware is in there so that you don't have to worry about battery life or you don't have to worry about a low quality screen and things like that. So it becomes a challenge. Some of these smartwatches are absolutely huge on your wrist. They take up an enormous amount of space and they've got a big battery that lasts a while, but they're bulky and uncomfortable. And then you've got ones like Samsung that even have a camera mounted on the side in case you feel like, you know, being a special agent. But you run into others which are a lot smaller and a lot more stylish, but the battery only lasts a day. And then it has kind of a funky charger that you have to, you know, clip on to make sure that it charges correctly. So it's a weird state right now. Smartwatches are in a really weird place in general. And I think companies like Google are going to help push that forward into something that has more of a defined shape that most people would be actually interested in spending money on instead of just something that geeks like me collect for fun.
We have just about a minute left to talk about the Tracker, a new device to help people who lose things a lot. What about Tracker? T-R-A-C-K-R.
This is a lot of fun, and if you actually head to the Tracker website, which is tracr.com, you can actually get one for free right now. Just by punching in your email address and your mailing address, they're trying to get a widespread adoption of this by sharing them with the world. I think they're only free for another day or two.
Okay.
But it's a tiny Bluetooth adapter that you can put on your keys or you can put on your backpack or something like that. And as long as you've got your phone on you, if you have lost that thing or misplaced it and it's within, you know, 20 feet, then you can set off the alarm on your phone and that thing will start beeping and going crazy. I've used it to find my keys like 10 times in the last week.
Wow.
And it has a separate function that has a button on the accessory itself. So if you've got your keys but you've misplaced your phone, you can push the button on the little dongle that's hanging. The phone will start ringing so that you can locate your phone as well.
Well, okay, I got to rush and go get my Tracker because I have somebody I know that really needs one. Russell Holly, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holly, tech blogger for geek.com. Go get your Tracker right now. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.